following Dharma talk was given by Lawrence Greco at the Interdependence Project in New York City. For more information, please visit www.openskyzen.com.
Tonight we're talking about the Bodhisattva ideal. What that means, what a Bodhisattva is, how this can inform our practice differently, and where it came from. So there's two quotes I want to read to you that I think epitomize the Bodhisattva path nicely. The first one is, a Bodhisattva is concerned about what she does, but not about what she receives. That's from the Avatamsaka Sutra. The second quote, I can decide what I give, but it's not up to me what I get given. That's from a Bjork song. But I love it. To me, they're expressing the same thing. So a bodhisattva, simply defined, is someone who's on track for enlightenment. But not just for themselves, but for all beings. That's what's fueling their practice. Initially, in early Buddhism, the term bodhisattva just referred to the Buddha himself before he reached enlightenment. So when he would tell stories about his pre-enlightenment years, he would refer to himself as a bodhisattva. From that point on, and for some centuries that followed, people assumed, because it was implied through his teachings and through the practice at the time, that there could only be one bodhisattva per era. So there's one bodhisattva, there's one person who has all the seeds of awakening, and they're doing everything they should be doing, and they're practicing hard, and they've had many, many lifetimes in preparation for this, and they'll become the next Buddha. So maybe one bodhisattva every 100 years or so. But over time, this created, especially, say, after around the first or second century when the Mahayana tradition began to develop, it's not completely clear when the Mahayana, or sometimes called the great vehicle or the Bodhisattva vehicle, when that began exactly. We think it's about the first or second century AC or thereabouts. So as Buddhist practice began to evolve and spread, people found it troubling to think, well, wait, there's only one person could become a full awakened Buddha? For every age? Does that seem right? Is that not contradictory to the Buddha's teachings and perhaps even more importantly, his example? So there was two paths, more or less, at the time. You could take the independent rogue path that the Buddha took. So leave your family behind or don't even get involved with a family. Don't have a regular civilian life. Go on your spiritual journey. Practice hard. Reach enlightenment, attain enlightenment. Or the Arahant approach. Basically meaning you've got to ordain as a monk or a nun, live in a monastery, follow the rules, follow the Eightfold Path, and then you could attain nirvana in this very life. Then you're an Arahant. So what people were having a problem with over time, though, was that both approaches seem rather narrow and even selfish. So is it enough to practice, to do this practice, to awaken to our true nature, to the true reality of things, right? To the nature of suffering and what causes suffering, to the reality of interdependence versus our usual, dualistic, separate view of the world? Is it enough to do all that just so that I could reach nirvana, just so I could extinguish this suffering and not have to be reborn again and again, as it was taught then? Is there not more to it? So when people were getting more restless and the Mahayana tradition was taking root and different sutras were being written that weren't necessarily written by the Buddha himself, or maybe not even during his time, but there were these sutras coming later that encapsulated his teachings. or that maybe repackage them based on where people were at that time. So the Lotus Sutra, for one, is a pretty famous Mahayana sutra, in which the Buddha is quoted as saying that anyone can attain Buddhahood. Anyone. He said men and women, anyone. Even saying that was considered radical to some people. So he said it's not about, in the Lotus Sutra, there was an emphasis on this isn't about intellectual study, this isn't about just following rules or a narrow path or having a narrow view. It's about having faith and devotion in your everyday. It's about making a practice out of your life. That's how you awaken. And you don't have to be a monk or a nun. You could just be a layperson. So all of a sudden, Buddhahood was open to everyone. Lay people, monastics, anyone. So this is a huge shift from the original Arahant ideal, right? So practice on this path, reach nirvana in this life, and then you're good. To a Bodhisattva ideal, which is, sure, work towards enlightenment. You're definitely on that path. You have all the right ingredients, you're doing all the right stuff, and you'll get there. But how about letting the desire to help all other people end their suffering and also reach enlightenment, how about letting that fuel your practice? Is that not, dare I say, better fuel for your practice? When we're motivated in that way, doesn't it change our perspective? Doesn't it even maybe inspire us more? Or get the urgency across more effectively? So out of this came the Bodhisattva vow. Many of you probably already heard it. There's all kinds of ways of wording it, but basically it's, may I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. Very simple vow we can take. So may I awaken, not just for my own benefit, not just to end my own suffering, but so that I can help end the suffering of all other people and help them wake up as well. Wonderful aspiration. So in Buddhist iconography, there are lots of wonderful bodhisattvas that are maybe perhaps based on real figures in history, but more likely they're just composites of different people or ideals. So my favorite one is this one here. And people at home, I'll describe it to you and put a picture up on the page. So in the Korean Zen tradition, he's called Jijang Bosal. In the Japanese Zen traditions, he's called Jizo. Usually looks very different than this. So I'll describe to you for those of you who aren't so close and aren't here with us in person. But he's the only bodhisattva who's actually a monk. So he's in monk's robes, usually depicted standing, but not always. And he has a staff, like a monk's staff in his hand, with six rings hanging from the top of the staff, which symbolizes how he's at one with people in the six realms, the heavenly realms, the hell realms, everywhere. And usually he's carrying in his other hand a wish-fulfilling jewel, a spear of some kind. So simply put, sometimes it's also referred to as, it's Jizo, who else? Oh yeah, the Sanskrit is Kshitgarbha Bodhisattva, maybe mispronouncing that. But simply put, we would say this is the Bodhisattva of the hell realms. Pretty intense. So his whole thing is, I'm going to forsake my own enlightenment until I can help people escape the suffering they're in whatever hell realm they happen to be in right now. That's his whole thing. So I love this bodhisattva as a almost like a role model or an example of what we can aspire to in the Mahayana path. Part of the legend says that with this big staff in his hand, he uses it to pry open the gates of hell. So he's actually not trying to free people. He's not just throwing people a life preserver. He's going down into the depths of hell where people need his help to help pull them out. I mean, I liken that to, we hear these stories of people who escape from a burning building. Then they're out and they realize, well, I'm safe, but there are people in there still about to burn. So they run back in and save them, right? So like, I'm not really safe until everyone else is safe. It's that kind of motivation. So over time, we've developed these, what we call these four great vows that you'll often hear recited at, often at Zen centers, but all kinds of centers, a lot of Mahayana centers, called the four great vows. So this is one variation of them that I like and that I use when I do a liturgy service once a year or so. So remember, the main vow is, may I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all beings. The four great vows go something like this. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. Delusions are endless. I vow to cut through them all. The teachings are infinite. I vow to learn them all. The Buddha way is inconceivable. I vow to attain it. Right? That's pretty intense. That's a tall order. When I first heard them being recited at a Zen center, I just thought, oh, God, I'm not up for this at all. You have to be a, right? I'm nowhere near being able to do all of that. Because learning, I'm not a quick learner. I don't think I'm a very smart man. Right? I'm far from enlightened. Yes, beings are numberless. Can I save them all? Phew. But isn't that the nature of a vow? So we have promises, we have aspirations. But a vow almost attempts to help us commit to do something which is essentially impossible, knowing it is impossible. So it doesn't matter. Can I literally save all beings from their suffering? No. The Dharma teachings, of course, they are so vast and infinite. There's so many ways of experiencing them intellectually and experientially. Can I ever master them all? No. So the impossible nature of these vows call our attention to the urgency that they present us with. Another bodhisattva is the bodhisattva of compassion, sometimes called Kuan Yin, or Avalokitesvara. My tradition, we call her Kuan Seum Bosal. Sometimes she's pictured weeping because she hears all the cries of the world, and she's, first of all, sad that other people are suffering. She shares their suffering, and she also knows she can't possibly help them all, but she tries. Sometimes this bodhisattva is depicted with, you know, hundreds of hands coming out from behind him or her. And sometimes with eyes on the hands. Right? It's like, I can see the suffering and I'm willing to help, offer a helping hand. Now in our tradition, we're trained when someone says, well, what is your job as a monk? Our response is, how can I help you? That's all. So it's not to be... And it's a good question to start considering for ourselves in this practice. Like, why do you practice? We all have different reasons why we came here, why we started meditating, why we came to the ID Project, or wherever else you might go. But what's fueling your practice? Again, initially for me, it was I just wanted to feel better. I didn't want to feel so crazy anymore. I didn't want to get so angry so easily. Do some of the things that I'm a little embarrassed about now that I've done in my past. And it absolutely helps with all of that. But that's not all of it. So hearing all this, these four vows, like vowing to save all beings, to master all the teachings, that could make us feel very inadequate and feel as if, well, am I supposed to just be constantly helping other people? And if I ever say no, am I a bad person? Or what if I try and fail? That's how I felt like when I first heard the four great vows. And there's a wonderful story I heard once about one of the Buddha's disciples. So he was deep in meditation, and all of a sudden he had this vision that the Kapila kingdom that he was in was going to be destroyed by war in 7 days. So he ran to the Buddha, and he said, "This kingdom is going to be destroyed by war in 7 days. Don't you know this, right?" And the Buddha said, "Yes, I do." So the disciple said, "Well, why don't you do something and prevent this from happening? Save them all." And the Buddha said, "I can't." "Well, why not? You're the Buddha, right? You're the awakened one. You have all these special powers and this deep insight. You could probably just give a 5-minute speech and they won't go to war." And the Buddha said, "You can't make merited karma disappear. You can't make merited karma disappear." Well, the disciple wasn't satisfied with that answer. So his desire to help and change the situation and save people from their suffering was so great that he was able to magically shrink the entire kingdom down to such a small size that it could be placed in a bowl. He put a lid in the bowl, and then he ascended to the heavenly realms with this bowl and left it there, where he knew it would be safe, and everyone in there would be safe, and he could avert the war and the suffering and the devastation. Came back to Earth. He kept practicing for 7 days. He actually gave it 8 days. Let me give it an extra day, just for good measure. Then he ascended back to the heavenly realm. With bowl in hand, he came back to Earth, very proud of himself for what he most likely accomplished. He took the lid off, and he saw that the miniature kingdom had been destroyed by a miniature war. But now he tried hard to avert a catastrophe. But what did the Buddha say? You can't change merited karma. So this has to inform the way in which we go about being bodhisattvas in this life, helping others, right? Working for enlightenment for the sake of other people. That's wonderful. But without wisdom, compassion doesn't work, right? All the compassion in the world isn't going to help anyone if I'm not clear in what's going on around me. If my view isn't clear and correct, if my direction isn't clear and correct, if I'm stuck in my ideas about how things ought to be, or my ideas about what's going on, then I can't help anyone. So it's about knowing, when can I make a difference, when can I not? When do I step in and help, when do I not? When do I ask someone if they want my help or not? Or when do I impose it on someone? Or my idea of helping you is this, whether you like it or not. Which sometimes that is helpful, sometimes no. Sometimes you have to meet people where they are. You know, I struggle. One of my closest friends of almost 20 years now has dealt with such severe depression and anxiety all her life, and has seen I don't know how many psychiatrists and been on all kinds of treatments and pills and medications. And now, for some people, it's necessary because there are some chemical or organic issues going on. For others, I don't know. So it's hard to see her suffer this way. And she has absolutely, probably next to no interest in Buddhism or meditation or anything. So, of course, what occurs to me is, just learn to meditate. Right? I was never where she was exactly, but gosh, the pills aren't doing it anymore. Or I don't know if they ever were. So now, just for the past, say, 2 years, and I would have never done this before, and, you know, it's considered very bad manners for a Buddhist to try to convert people. That's why we don't have as many numbers as certain other traditions. You don't see, right? You don't see us on the streets usually pontificating. I said, well, every once in a while, I just very gently say, hey, you know, maybe you should learn to just meditate. You know, I'd be happy to teach you. Right? That's what I do. I'm your best friend. Let's just learn to meditate. Maybe it'll help you feel a little better. And okay, yeah, maybe, and then no, nothing. So that's, you know, that's not where she is yet. Maybe something huge has to happen for her to come around to practice. Maybe she never will. You don't know. So I'm going to leave you with a koan. I'm starting to enjoy doing this. So I love the, I just like the expressions on your face when I say it. Because koans are not meant to be understood easily. They can't be answered logically. And frankly, it just entertains me to see you looking baffled. So there's a few koans that we say are relevant to the Bodhisattva way, to the Bodhisattva path. So one is this. A monk asked Zen Master Joju, I want to learn from you. I want to reach enlightenment. I want you to be my teacher. So the Zen master said, okay, did you have breakfast just now? And the student says, yes. Yes, Zen master, I did. And Joju replied, go wash your bowl.
That's it.
If people don't look baffled, they look like they're saying, and? And then what? And then what's the point? I don't know if I should show the other one or not. No.
Oh.
Should I?
Do it.
All right, I'll do the second one. It's a little bit longer. So there was another Zen master in a big a monastery with 500 students. His name is now... My teacher hates that I cannot pronounce these names. He just gets mad at me. It's funny. I think it's Namjung. Probably wrong. Joju is easy, but Namjung, I don't know. So Zen Master Namjung, they're all like Korean names. I don't know. I don't speak Korean. So there was this huge hall. The point is, of 500 monks and nuns practicing, right? They lived there. This was their whole life. One day, a stray cat strolls in. And one group, a group of 250, half of the hall says, oh, we found a cat. This is like our little mascot. This is our little kitty now. This is our little Zen cat.
A bodhicattva.
Yes. These two love cats, I know. They like love this story. I'm sure many of you love cats, right? No, not Audrey. So then a few days later, the cat strolls on over to the other side of the hall because they have better food. So guess who thinks it's their cat? Right? The people in the north hall now think it's their cat. So they say, oh, we have this beautiful little kitty. This is our little Zen cat. Then eventually the South Hall people who thought they had a cat realized the North Hall people have their cat. And there was war. They were like arguing over this for days and debating over it. Blah, blah. And everyone was feeding the cat in the meantime. But everyone was very stuck on whose cat is this. So Zen Master Namjung sees this going on, grabs the cat by its nape. Is that what you call it?
Yeah.
The nape, right? Holds it up in front of the hall, gets on his high podium with a big knife, a big long knife. And he says, you all love this cat, huh? You really love this cat. You're arguing over it, so you must really love it if you're fighting over it so loudly. So if just one of you could say the words I want to hear, I will spare this cat's life. All I need to hear is one word from one of you. And if not, I'm going to slice its head off. So in a room full of 500 monks and nuns, adults, practicing for years, right, following all the rules and sitting in meditation all the time and wearing the uniforms and, right, shaving their heads, no one could give him the answer that would have saved this cat's life. So he sliced its head off, and that was it. So the question we would normally ask a student, and we're not asking you to answer it now, is what could have anyone said? What was wrong there? Why did the cat die? Why was the cat killed?
Thank you for listening to this podcast. For more information, please visit OpenSkyZen.com.